And good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Leah M., recovered compulsive overeater and the moderator for this morning. Today is Sunday, June 9th, 2024. The share ID numbers for Friday, June 7th, are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 21,470. That's 21,470. And for the 10 a.m. Eastern Big Book Study, 21,471. That's 21,471. This morning, A Vision for You presents, Of Myself, I Am Nothing. All of us have come to this program, Overeaters Anonymous, as a result of the suffering, frustration, and despair we experienced in our disease of compulsive overeating. Beaten into a state of reasonableness, we come to the realization that we are doomed. We've realized that anything that comes from our own resources, our will, our efforts, our philosophy, morality, goals, or our good intentions won't solve our problem of compulsive overeating. Our human resources alone simply aren't sufficient. Our experience of powerlessness becomes our driving force of desperation to be ready and to be willing to do anything which will free us from the bondage of our affliction. The purpose of the Big Book is to change your life through a 12-step process of personal transformation leading to a connection with power, God, a spiritual awakening sufficient to overcome compulsive overeating. If you're suffering from compulsive overeating, the Big Book provides clear directions as to how you can experience such an awakening through a process of searching, praying, and taking action. Those of us who have walked this path can assure you of its effectiveness. We once suffered in hopelessness and despair too. Now we are new people with a new purpose. We have been transformed as a result of finding and establishing a relationship with power. We are taken from the world of self-will and self-reliance to a path of God-reliance. Joining us today to speak on this topic is Terry C., a recovered compulsive overeater from New Jersey. Terry has had a profound transformation as a result of the 12 steps and a relationship with God, and she's here to share her experience, her strength, and her hope with all of us today. And it's a delight to welcome Terry C. to the line this morning. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Leah. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Leah. I'm so glad your introductions are recorded because your introductions are so poignant and something always to reflect on. Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone. My fellows, good morning. My name is Terry C. I'm a compulsive overeater from New Jersey, from southern New Jersey on the east coast of the USA. And yes, of myself, I am nothing. I have on this meeting, and I am a student of the Big Book, but I am still enamored every day by Bill's story. And the line in Bill's story that I chose to expand on today is found on page 13, and it's become a prayer for me. And basically, in the line where Bill sums up his attempt to do these principles, to follow these principles, for the first time, he says, I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. And I often reflect on these words. They resonate with me to the core of my being because they to me, underpin everything this book tells me on every page. Everything on every page is related to the idea that without God is the worst way for me to live. It's the worst way for me to live. And I thought we'd start out because my second favorite book is The Dictionary. And I never really looked up these two words. I never looked up the meaning of lost or nothing. And I thought, of course, you know, they're basic words in our English vocabulary, but it was very telling to me. God speaks to me through the dictionary. I know that sounds funny, but to have an open mind, I need the dictionary because I think I know, but I don't always know. And the word lost, according to Merriam, according to Webster's, is the first definition blew me away. Destroyed or ruined physically or morally. I'm going to continue and I'll come back to these. The second definition was not to be found, missing. The third was no longer held or possessed, parted with. The fourth was no longer seen, heard, or known. The fifth was not gained or won, attended with defeat. The sixth was having wandered from the way, uncertain as to one's location. And number seven, bewildered or ill at ease. I feel like every page of the big book speaks to me and warns me about being in all of those places. The word nothing, not as long a definition, but also very telling. No thing, not anything. Number two, non-existence, insignificance, unimportant. Three, a thing that does not exist, a person considered of no value or importance. Today, I'm still blown away by those definitions. I'm blown away, and I feel when Leia asked me to speak, the first thing I thought of was how I get wrapped up in this phrase and how every day it shows me new meaning, and I have a conviction to it. So I thought it might be a good idea to kind of walk through some of my favorite pages in the book, which and passages from the book that resound what this means to me, what this actually means, and what I've experienced in my life, both when I walked in here, both before I walked in here, when I walked in here, while I've been here, and recently up until this week. So when I look at lost, destroyed or ruined physically or morally, I feel like it's a perfect description of what it was like when I walked in here and how badly damaged and how badly ruined I was by this disease. The doctor's opinion talks about torture. To me, it's relative to that definition. It talks about their lost self-confidence. Their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. I mean, morally, that's ruined for me, and that's exactly where I was. And then it talks about, in the doctor's opinion, how when we get in that cycle, when we get in that vicious cycle, the food cycle, the remorse, the hopelessness, and the firm resolution not to do it again, because mainly I have a philosophical conviction and a moral conviction not to do it, but I have no power to change that, and I keep doing it, and I keep doing it, and I keep doing it. And then the phrase that just captures that moral ruin, that self-hatred, self-loathing is, in More About Alcoholism, it talks about the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. There's that moral again. Leia used the word moral. That moral reliance is not reliable. Like, to rely on my morals. See, I know it's not the right thing to do. I know, and I could bring that full circle and come to my behavior in a given week of late and know it's not the right thing to do. I know it's not the right thing to do. I and yet I can't stop myself from doing it. That's a perfect explanation about my illness with food, and it's a perfect explanation of alcoholic behavior or agnostic behavior that can pop up when I'm not connected to God. And that's what these two phrases remind me over and over again. My connection with God doesn't find me in a place where I'm always lost. It doesn't find me in a place where I'm of no use to others and insignificant and nothing. But I'm easily there when I'm disconnected from God. And when I walked in here, a connection with God was not on my mind, was not anything I could fathom, was not anything I knew to value and have be the most important thing in my life and have it be the conviction that keeps my life going. So in our OA 12 and 12, one of the lines says, we ate to sate the fears, the angers, and the disappointments. I couldn't see it then, but when I walked in here, I didn't realize that food was my symptom. I thought it was my problem. I thought weight was my problem. I thought, you know, if I could just, I was that person described in the OA 12 and 12. If I could just lose weight, life would be perfect. I'm 5'1 and a half. I probably weighed over 230 pounds when I walked in here. And the demoralization I felt every minute of every waking minute. It was either demoralization over the behavior that I couldn't stop or demoralization over the human race that I was so separate and apart from. It was true demoralization. In A Vision for You, on the first page, it talks about the four horsemen. And ironically, one of the four horsemen is bewilderment. And ironically, one of the definitions of lost is bewildered. So I was certainly lost. I was certainly lost when I walked in here. I was certainly lost. There's so many parts of the book that talk about my lack of power, choice, and control. I couldn't see that when I walked in here. I was going to make my life right. I was trying so hard to get to the point that I would be happy with you, I would be happy with me, and I would have a life that was the one I longed for. And I couldn't see when I walked in here that the mistake was thinking I had the power to achieve that. And the second step was something that, for me, is probably, I would love to say I walked in here with a faith and it wasn't the most difficult step, but I see now in hindsight how it has become such a critical step for me, such a critical principle for me. I won't call it a step, but it's a critical principle for me. You know, it's the whole idea of the chapter devoted to that step, we agnostics, is knowledge of God. And these two phrases that we're focused on this morning, being lost, being nothing, that's where I am without knowledge of God. That's where I am without a relationship with God. But I came in here grossly obese and thinking, not that I was nothing, feeling like nothing, but thinking I was something, trying continually to be something, and thinking that something was going to give me the power I needed to be okay. I could not see that that was never going to be the case. I could not see it was a lost battle. I could not see it was the fight that I would never win. And it was a fight. It was a fight. So In step two, I couldn't see my lack of power, and I couldn't even understand what people were talking about when they talked about lack of power, because in charge was always something that felt comfortable to me. It was always what got me through. I'm the oldest of six children, and the roles that God didn't assign me were easy for me to create. They were just easy. They still can be. They still can be, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. I was too smart when I walked in here for God. I was too smart for God. My intelligence, and that's what's the beauty of the chapter of We Agnostics, because it tells me over and over and over again that I need to have an open mind because my intelligence will get me nowhere. And, you know, we come on these meetings and I'm talking to you this morning and I'm trying to make sense out of this book. And I'm hoping, you know, if I really get into myself and get away from God, I'll be focused on how much I can relate to you, exactly what I need you to hear. And all of that is a waste. That effort is a waste. All I can do is plead and ask God to help me represent him, which is something when I walked in here, I wouldn't have had a clue about. I mean, not representing him and being of myself led me to the binges and the food counters and the repeated meals and whatever it is, as a compulsive overeater, the agony of compulsive overeater, the eating, the torture of compulsive overeating that you might relate to. That's where I was. That's where I was. I couldn't see my lack of power. But I learned something that was interesting at first, and later I became more curious about it. And today I try to practice it, and that is the idea of a new attitude. Because in charge, knowing everything, got me over 230 pounds. At some point, I was able to start to see that the people who were telling me that I needed to open my mind weren't suffering that way anymore. See, pain's going to happen in my life, but suffering is an option, and that's what happens when I'm removed from God, disconnected from God. And I didn't know how to get there. I saw people with a connection, but I didn't know how to get there. And today it's still the way to get there, and it's an attitude change. It's belief in the power, and it's an attitude change. The attitude that's mentioned several times in the book. And that attitude only comes about when I can do what the set-aside prayer tells me to do. When I can open my mind, practice humility, when I can seek the truth, want the truth, and face the truth, which is the honesty it tells me I need to do, and be willing, be diligent, be as diligent as I can about practicing these principles. My old ideas can be very fixed, and they can come back because beliefs die hard. They die hard. But we agnostics repeatedly tells me that all this logic and all this understanding that I think I have sometimes is of no avail, of no use when it comes to a relationship with God, all times. I shouldn't say sometimes. So I came in here judging God because I felt that I was better than needing God or living on a spiritual basis. But Leah said it in the beginning, I'm doomed. I'm doomed. I have two choices. This is the book of two choices. There's never a third choice. There's always two choices. And it says in the beginning of We Agnostics, I can be doomed or live on a spiritual basis. I can live on a spiritual basis or die. It doesn't use the word die. It says or else. To me, it's die. It's either dying a spiritual death, a physical death, or an emotional death. And I guess the thing that I think about is how non-existence, you know, no thing. I thought I was something, no thing without God, no thing. And I become useless. If we look at the devilments on page 52, I was immersed in them and living them regularly every second of my life. They talk about having trouble with personal relationships, having trouble with my emotional nature, my emotions, not being useful, not being happy, you know, can't be of real help to other people. Those are so related to what we're talking about this morning. Unimportant, don't exist, no value, no longer known, seen, or heard. I can't be helping me if I'm not helping you. I'm just helping me. And that's of myself. Of myself. So there's a line in Bill's story, and there's a line at the end of We Agnostics about needing and wanting God. I had to see my loss of power. I had to see that the symptom of compulsive overeating was going to destroy my life. And then, of course, see the unmanageability in my life, which was much more profound for me to see than the physical size of my being. but the unmanageability. Because nowhere in these steps, except the first one, does it talk about food. And it doesn't in the first step tell me what to do with food. I just have to get clear on the destruction of my life when it comes to this disease, which ultimately is a spiritual malady. It's a spiritual malady. So needing and wanting God. And the big book basically tells me when I need God and I want God, and of course, the second step says when I'm willing to even believe a hint of that idea, I have a chance of getting well. I have a chance of getting better. You know, without Him, I am nothing. Without means not with. Not with God. When I'm not with God, I'm with Terry. And being with Terry is an unhealthy and unsafe place to be. It's an unsafe place to be. So it brings me to step three. I'm just going to try to dance through, because it's in this amount of time, dancing through these steps, I believe, is with His leadership is the best I can do. But I think about step three, and step three tells me at this point, if I see my loss of control, and I see my loss of power, and I see my loss of choice, I must be convinced. I must be convinced that I have this illness, that I have compulsive overeating, that on my own power, I'm never going to change that. If I could stop myself, if my philosophical convictions and everything I ever knew was right, I could do, I wouldn't need this program. I wouldn't need to be here this morning. I wouldn't need anything but me, because I'd be the power. And I came in here emotionally crippled, physically about to be, and spiritually bankrupt. And the third step tells me I have to get the simple relationship straight. I am not the power. I'm not the parent. I'm not the principal. I'm not the director, right? We all know how beautifully Bill uses the analogy of the director of the show. I'm just going to go to page 60 a minute, if you would, with me. I just want to look up that page real fast. Hold on one second. Page 60. Being convinced of what? That I can't manage my own life, that I have some kind of illness. I have something going on with me that it might not be described in medical or clinical journals in the way that I understand it. But there's no stopping it. I'm doing something I don't want to do for reasons I don't understand, and I don't know why. I mean, that is just insane. You know, second step tells me I'll be restored to sanity, because heaven knows I live by insanity. And then it says, convinced that no human power, especially mine, no sponsor, no. You know, emotional power driven by family, none of that is going to change me. And that God could and would if He were sought. Again, woven throughout the book, that God could and would if He were sought, woven throughout this phrase that we're focused on this morning, being nothing, being lost without Him. But seeking Him, I have a chance not to be lost. I have a chance to be of use to Him. So, and Bill did use that exact language in the original manuscript, which I love, after he talks about on page 62, when he starts to talk about, we had to quit playing God, it didn't work, which is the resolve that the third step is asking me to make, turn my will and my life over to God, because the resolve is that I can't be the power in my life, and I can't continue to be the power in my life, and whenever I try to be the power in my life, it's going to get screwed up. It just does, because that's never the way it was supposed to be. God didn't create me to be the power. I don't take His job. But when Bill wrote the words on page 62, he added in the original manuscript when he talked about, we decided that God was going to be the director, and he talked about he's the parent and he's the principal. He said, get this, somewhere in there, he wrote, get this simple relationship straight. And it was taken out for the people that felt Bill was a little too harsh. But I often think about it and think about and thank him for that warning and thank him for that kind of urgency, because it is the simple relationship. I have to get straight. I have to get straight. So all of this, when I think about it, with defeat, lost, one of the definitions is with defeat. I need that defeat to get to step three. I need to understand the jig is up. I never was the power in my life. I never was going to correct my life. I never was going to be the reason that I had physical recovery. You know, I had to have the willingness, but that all came from God. That was a gift from God. It still remains a gift from God. So I need step three to understand step four. And there's no coincidence that in the book, we say the third step prayer, and it's not long before, a paragraph later, next we launched on this course of vigorous action. And the reason being is, once I remember that I'm not the power, once the realization comes through that I'm not going to fix it, once the realization comes through that self-reliance is never going to fix it, it's never going to make me okay, I have to look at how I got to the point that I needed to convince myself. I have to look at that. And that's true of me today, and it was true when I started to understand these steps. Because if you're new, it might sound difficult, but the idea is that the steps tell us we continue to practice, we continue to improve, and we continue. And that's the thing I love about the fourth step that I would like to get into now. The fourth step, I just want to stop because I see I got a message. Can I be heard okay? Can I be heard?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes,
we can hear you clearly.
Yes.
I'm gonna try to speak louder if that helps. Okay, so I need God to be fearless and thorough. I can't be fearless and thorough and be honest on my own. I'm not capable of it. I prove that. You know, I used to have a friend in program that said, I found a nickel, I'll tell you I found a dollar. Like, I'm a great exaggerator. And the person I'm best at deluding is me. The person I'm best at you know, falsifying things for is me. So the connection of the third step to the fourth step to me is just so clear, just like many of the other ones. They come in the perfect order. And the whole idea is, if I'm at a point where I'm seeing behavior and all of a sudden I realize I'm not connected to God, you need to see how I get disconnected, because usually there's fear driving that. Fear is driving it in some way. And I'm going to go to page 16. It says on the top of 64, though our decision was a crucial step that could have little permanent effect, it left at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. That is not an event in my life. That is the vigilance I need every day to make sure I'm connected, to make sure I'm not blocked, because it happens. It happens. And if you're new, when you're learning the skill set, know that it's a life skill set. For me, it's a life skill set. You know, it's not an event. It doesn't get over. If it did, we wouldn't have the 10th step. We wouldn't have the 11th step. It doesn't get over. So pay attention to the skill set. I know I'm still learning it. I'm still trying. You know, I'm still understanding the value of this skill set. every day in my life. But I want to use the fourth step to kind of bring a current issue to life, because I feel like telling you the experience is a much better way than just kind of valuing parts of the book. It says resentment destroys us. It destroys us. Ironically, the definition of loss is destroyed physically or morally. And isn't it funny? Physically, I was destroyed when I walked in. Morally, I can still be destroyed, especially when I'm not connected to God. When I'm being gracious, kind, patient, considerate, and ultimately I have to be honest with myself and say, there's a motive. There's a motive. It's not genuine. Something else is happening. Or when I'm discounting a disturbance, a disappointment. I heard recently that a resentment occurs when something is not as I think it should be. It's plain and simple for me. And every day I can wake up to something not being as I think it should be. Every day. So just two other general points, then I want to get into a real life situation. But the top of 66 tells me that I'm going to die. I'm going to die if I stay in this business of resentment. I'm going to die. Somewhere on this page, it tells me, there it is. With me to eat is to die. For when harboring such feelings, I shut myself off from the sunlight of the spirit. That's the block. Whenever I'm disturbed, whether I acknowledge it or I try to put it under the rug, I'm going to die if I don't face it, if I don't face and be rid of and look at the truth about it. Because inevitably, resentment for me is a fear that didn't just come up in my 66th year of life. A resentment for me probably came up in another part of my life early on, and this is a reminder of it. This new one is a reminder of it. So that having been said, just to bring you into a real life example, my 83-year-old mother this week moved into a senior apartment after living in a senior community where she was very happy for 10 years or at least lived her life as best she could, having been a widow for the last 8 years. And all my family works except for me. All my siblings work except for me, and I'm the retired one. So, and I happen to be the oldest. And so I offered to help more and be there to, coordinate, help her do what she needed to do to pack up and move, which if you've ever done it, no, it's quite an effort. So I knew something was off. I could see behavior like, well, I was excited for her. Well, I'm afraid for her. You know, I'm concerned about her. These were things I was discounting, you know, concerned about, you know, her health. But I saw behavior coming out that was uneasy, feeling interfered with at points. And I'll be honest and tell you, I let it go on for a few weeks. Couldn't really see it, just was caught up in trying to be the helpful one. And then I found myself complaining to my brother-in-law about the realtor involved in selling my mom's house. And I knew it was time to get honest and look at what was going on. And it was looking at the resentment with the realtor to see that he wasn't who he said he was going to be, that I got in touch with a resentment that can come up and flare up different times in my life from way back when, and the resentment is, I'm not always who I say that I'm. So the realization and the mirror, the equal sign, was real apparent that the other thing I resented was he wasn't representing my mom's best interests. And when I looked at some of my behavior around my mom's move, I got to see that I wasn't really representing my mom's best interest. that I was just trying to make everything okay so I could be okay, because if she was okay, then I could be okay. And if that isn't selfish and lost and without God, nothing is. But there was something more there. There was just something more there. And as I got into, I really wasn't sure where to go with it. And I can't do an inventory without God's direction. And of course, that comes to me through prayer. And it comes to me through other fellows. And so I was challenged to look deeper at the fears involved and how I was showing up in the relationship, which for me is the sex conduct direction and inventory. And I really got to see something that I had to recognize and face, and that was the fear that this is that much closer to what might be the end of my mom's life. Not that I know when my mom's going to die, or not that I know that she's going soon, but just the idea that she's moving on to something where more help is needed and she's giving up. But the real eye opener was that I walked in here suffering from the disease of compulsive eating and understanding better my disease, which I still work with others to understand, and realizing with my mom, who's one of us, who I believe is a compulsive overeater, who's actually participated in Overeaters Anonymous at times, that I was still fighting this disease because I was watching my mom succumb to the physical ailments she has because of this disease. And it was just very humbling to have to see that at this point in my recovery, I can still battle this disease. It may not be because of my personal experience with it, but watching my mom, watching her life be in ruin because of it. And that sounds like a judgment, which I really don't want to do, but watching something's quality of life be destroyed, watching a quality of life be destroyed. Without this program, I would not get to see that truth. I would not get to be humble in admitting to you about that truth. I would be lost. I would be defeated and uncertain and wandering and bewildered and not know why. And not know why, but that kind of fight separates me from God. That kind of willfulness that I think I know, separates me from God. I'm of zero value and importance to my mom when I'm judging the disease, her realtor, my brother-in-law, whoever else I want to carry along for the resentment ride. I'm of zero value. And I had to get honest. I had to ask for help. I had to, you know, I had to talk to some fellows, and that's what the fifth step tells me. Like, I want to hide it all. I want to come to the conclusion and know I came to the conclusion. And if that was enough, we wouldn't have a fifth step. But in the fifth step, I've learned that's where I can actually build my connection even more strongly to God. Because I'm talking to God when I'm talking to another fellow doing the fifth step. I'm seeing the truth. It may be terrifying. It takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage. When I'm in a fifth step myself, or I do a fifth step with anyone, prayer has to be the way we start it. And prayer has to be the way what we do during and after. Because I want to see the truth. I don't want to keep lying to myself about what's going on. That's how I got to the fourth step. It's a delusion. You know, one of the frequent questions I ask myself in inventory is, where am I mistaken here? And with my mom, that helped me come to an ideal that I didn't have until recently. And it's an ideal that would have been great if I had it long ago, but I needed to come here to get it. And the realization, and I mean, the ideal today I have for my mom comes right out of our Vision for You prayer. God will bless her and keep her. He will bless her and keep her, and I need to give her the dignity to have that relationship with her God. And I don't need a real complicated ideal. It's that plain and simple. It's come to that today for my mom. And when I think about that ideal and I have a resolve and conviction toward it, I'm no longer lost about my mom. I'm very clear. I'm not bewildered. I'm not ill at ease. I'm very clear about my role. See, I had a role that I assigned myself. I got to see that in my fear inventory with my mom. And the role I assigned myself was that I was her protector and guardian. And I'll just say humorously, one of the things I got to tell another fellow is, you know, when you're the oldest in your family of multiple siblings and someone has given you power of attorney, executorship, whatever those other titles are, people like me need to be reminded they are not God roles. They are servant roles. And I needed to get real. I needed to get right size to see the distinction between them. And I can misinterpret them and disconnect from God. I can misinterpret them. I need to be consulting with God on a regular basis on any decisions I make as a power of attorney, executorship, or anything that involves being in a support role for anyone. But let me check my time here. Okay. So what I love about step 6 and 7 is that they are just 2 paragraphs because they are the simple conclusion of what I've been learning in 4 and 5. If I've been honest, I've been thorough, if I've really been searching, because we go back through our lives. We go back through our lives. Many times I have to go back and say, when did this fear first start? When did I become my mom's protector? When did I decide that, you know, I was the only authentic person on the face of the earth and everyone else is insincere? Like, when did that start? Or when was it that I learned to mistrust people and think that that was the only way to get through? So, but 6 and 7 remind me and bring me to the point that I'm brought to when I sincerely look at behind me at this state of resentment and see I'm never going to be the power in my life. I'm not the power. And on my own power, that was the best I could do. And now I'm ready for God to take me to better things, but it's only on His terms. I just have to be ready and willing. It's only on His terms. My job is to be of use. My job is to be something for Him. Right? On step 10, it says our will comes back to us when we realize we're using it for him, for you, for him, for others, to be of value to him and others. I get ready for God and only God to do these things, you know? So one of the lines in the 8th step on page 76, where we have step 6 and 7, says, we attempt to sweep away, above it says repair the damage, but we attempt to sweep away the debris which is accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. There's that show again, that director. And it's so clear to me when I take the time and effort to hold things up to the light. Leia talked in the beginning about, you know, having to really see things a different way. When I make that attempt and bring God in and I'm able to have a light that shows me the things, the honesty and the truths that I need to see, I can see that self-reliance is going to fail me every time, that self-will is going to take me away from God, that I can't be relying on God and be fearful at the same time. But when I'm driven by fear, there's going to be no trusting God until I turn to God. And then something can change. And in step 9, my experience has been exactly what it says when it says, we have to ask God for help with these amends. We have to ask God for help. And I learned once, and I thought it sounded really good. Like, to make an amends, you have to be on good spiritual ground and in close connection with God. And I've probably repeated that to people on this line. And the truth is, you really need to understand that's true. And the meaning of that is important. It's important. for everything, not just, it's not just, it doesn't just sound good, and it's not for my first amends that I ever make. It's for any amends that I make. I have to seek direction from God. And that brings me to the 10th step. I continue inventory because I have to watch for when I'm without God, when I am of myself. But it doesn't say I watch and I judge. Like, I didn't come through these steps to assign myself value now as a reformed person who can never make a mistake again. And that's not the justification for making mistakes. I just recognize my humanness and my lack of power. I have to watch and turn. I have to watch and turn. I don't watch and judge. Judgment is only for God. It's not for me. And I don't have a God that's a harsh judge, or he doesn't judge at all. Continue, which is why I say it's a skill set. I have to stay in inventory now. And I'm taking somebody through inventory right now, and I'm reminding her on a regular basis, this is what we do for life. This is what we do for life. We hold it up to the light. We see it from a different angle. We open our minds. We get honest. We get willing to see the truth. We look for the facts. In step 11, improving conscious contact with God. I get, it says we just started to have, it's in step 10, in step 11, it says we just started to have this. We being still inexperienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it's not probable we're going to be inspired all the time. Like, we need to keep improving our conscious contact with God the best way we know how. And the best way I know how is to remember prayer and meditation on a regular basis, not as an event in my day. It is an event in my day to some extent because it works for me best in the morning, but it's a repeated thing. You know, it's a repeated thing to remind myself throughout the day that my life is about being guided by God. Do I remember that all the time? It would be wonderful if I did. It would be wonderful. I have this scene. I like movies. And if you've seen the script, or you're a first responder, or however you picture this in your mind, but there's the scene where someone has either been tragically hurt, or they're taking their, you know, they're tragically ill, or they might be taking their last breath, and the emergency responder or the loved one is saying, "Stay with me, stay with me, stay with me." That's my step 11. God is pleading for me to stay with him. And I have to work at it, or I'm going to lose my breath and go under. I have to work at it. And the way I work at it isn't just prayer and meditation. 12th step tells me practice these principles in all my affairs. In all my affairs. So, but of course the 12th step tells me also about working with others, not just in the room, working with others. You know, I remember a woman that I met in this meeting, I think, talked about her smile campaign. It's as simple as that. It can be as simple as that, and it can be as simple as being on that phone when someone's ready to end it all. Like, it's service. It's realizing that I'm put here for that, and my time and effort and concentration on seeing with my mom. With my mom, being patient when she tells me the sixth time the same thing, you know, realizing that that's the best she can do. It's the best she can do. So I think I'd like to just mention that I said it in the beginning, everywhere in this book, I'm reminded about being without God will doom me. It will bring me to my demise. But it also has lots of passages, and I need a whole other meeting to read all the passages, or some of the passages even, that tell me what my life can be like with God, what my life can be like when I'm not of myself. We read the paragraph every day on this meeting at the end of Vision for You, right? And we know, like, great events are going to come to pass. Great events. If my relationship with God, the simple one Bill talked about, is right, great events are going to come to pass, not just in these rooms, great events. Like we hear the miracles on the meeting every day. And in the book, it talks about all the, you know, there's so many promises, right? It's a 10-step promises. If that doesn't convince you, I mean, neutrality, I'm not lost when I'm in neutrality. I'm not of no use to anyone and nothing when I'm in neutrality, when I'm safe and protected, when I know that unseen God guard is around me because I'm connected. Like, I would love for that to be 24/7. I have to work at that. I have to work at that. I have to stay, again, set aside prayer. I remember thinking it was a cute little prayer. And now it guides my life. How honest am I? If I'm honest, open-minded, and willing, I'm not in resentment. But I'm in resentment, there's a good chance none of that is going on. None of that is going on. So I just want to close today. I think it's my time, but I think God's telling me it's my time. But on that page where I took this passage from, on page 13 in Bill's story, I mean, after that, the page is important to me because, again, on the bottom, it talks about what I just mentioned, belief in the power of God on page 13, the bottom, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain a new order, the order where I don't want to be lost. I don't want to be nothing. These are the essential requirements. But the next paragraph just resounds what the remedy is, resounds what where I need to live, what I need to pay attention to. Simple, but not easy. My life is simple, but it's not easy. A price has to be paid. It means destruction of self. Destruction of self-centeredness, the destruction of self. Destruction of myself. Destruction of myself. And then it says, I turn, because I don't want to be lost. I don't want to be bewildered. I don't want to be missing. I don't want to wander from the path. I turn all things, this talk, calls, texts that I might get after, all things over to the Father of Light who presides over us all. Thank you very much. Thank you, Leia, for the opportunity, and I hope it's helpful to someone.
Thank you. Thank you, Terry C., for your thorough and inspiring presentation this morning. Another gem for the archive, such an illuminating share of the wisdom found in the big book and how you have applied it in your life. Thank you so very much. The share ID for today's presentation, 21,472. That's 21472. Terry C's contact information will be given at the conclusion of this recording, so please stay tuned for that. And we will now transition to question and answer segment. You can pose a question, questions only, to Terry by pressing *1 to unmute. I need your name, including the first letter of your last name.
Hi, it's Carolyn S. in New York.
Carolyn S.
Melissa C.
Gotcha, Melissa. Who else has a question for Terry this morning? *1 to unmute. Okay. Well,
Aaliyah A.
All right. Let's get started with these three. I've got Carolyn S., Melissa C., and Aaliyah A. We'll gather more after. Let's begin with Carolyn S., please. Well, let's wait a minute. I think Terry. Let's begin with the question from Carolyn S., please. Go ahead. Carolyn S., please go ahead with your question, please.
I'm sorry, it automatically muted me. Okay, so my question is about how can you be helpful to your mother? I'm in a similar situation with aging parents. My dad's 98, my mom's 88, and she's basically giving up her life to serve him, and to the point that I think she might die before he does. And I've tried so many ways to help her, you know, to give her advice on support groups and so on and so forth, and she won't take it. And she is of, you know, good mind, clear mind. So what can I do to help besides, of course, you know, be in recovery and set an example? Thank you.
Hi, Carolyn. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm kind of going to go back to one of the last things that I said. I really do believe that I have to consult God on any question. And I really believe when I'm sincere and honest and really want God's help, you know, it says in the book, right? When we want him and need him, he comes, he shows up. I really believe the direction comes. It may not come on my terms and in my timelines, but I really believe it comes because I gave this talk today because I believe that. And I think the practical advice is not something that I'm being led to talk about and probably isn't of this arena. But I really believe that we can't do step 12 without step 11. And what you're asking about is how to serve your mom. So I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn S., for your question. Melissa C., your turn.
Hi, good morning. It's Melissa C., recovered compulsive overeater in New York. Thanks, Leah, for your service. Good to hear you. And, Terry, you know, I just want to say, like, I received a text from friend in program who was like, what? She's telling exactly your situation right now. So I really appreciate that. And, you know, just want to, say that I really, you gave a lot of yourself. And specifically, you know, I love this, the line, you know, about of myself, I'm nothing. And then you alluded, you know, that great events will come to us. And I would just love to hear some, now that, you know, maybe you're like a step ahead of me. By the way, I'm the youngest of five, and I have a situation with my mom. So I see it from my perspective, you know, which I would tell you is, you know, whatever, it's all on me. But I want to, you know, I could really use some of your hope. Tell me some great events that came to you. Thanks.
Oh, wow. great events continue to happen. You know, one of my original sponsors, in OA, said, it's not the miracle, Terry, it's the perception. And some might think that discounts God's miracles, but I really believe with God's lenses, so many things can be miracles. But, great events. Wow. Okay. Well, I have an unimaginable life today. Everybody would want my problems. But the most great events for me, you know, It says events, but I want to tell you the relationships that have healed in my life. I'm not going to tell you they've all healed, but I'm going to give you two specific ones, one that's healed and one that's healing. I have a relationship with my son today beyond my wildest dreams, and it was rough going with my 33-year-old son because he started off life in an unfair situation. He was not my firstborn. I lost my firstborn child, and he was born appearing like he was the firstborn, but he wasn't. And there's been a lot of, you know, my own work that I've had to do around that. But let me finish by saying that I did an inventory. I did a few inventories that helped me see that somewhere along the way is a hovering, fearful mom because he was my consequent pregnancy. I had to give him when he turned 21, especially, although I didn't learn this till the inventory happened, probably when he was 28, I had to give him his dignity back. I had stolen his dignity, and I couldn't see that I took that from him. And often we see that in inventory, that we take something from the other person that we need to give back to them. And that's been one of the huge miracles in my life today, the realization of that, which came from God, and the blessings in this relationship that I'm not going to say, there aren't times when, you know, just like any other mom, he drives me crazy. with his decisions, but, you know, how dare he make his mistakes? And God's still trying to teach me the truth about that one. And then with my daughter, she was my baby and she was my subsequent girl. And today I'm still learning that there are choices that she makes that aren't mine, and God's helping me see that she belongs to him. She belongs to him, and that many of her choices are between her and her God. So I know I didn't give you earth-shattering events. I could tell you about, you know, my trip to San Diego where I needed an OA meeting and I popped in a cab, and a woman that someone in New Jersey mentioned to me 3 days before was in the cab and was on her way to an OA meeting. I mean, those kinds of miracles just abound in my life. But the meaningful ones were the ones I told you earlier about. So we could talk forever. I'll leave my number. Give me a call. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa C. Aaliyah A., your turn to pose a question.
Thank you, Leah, for your service. And thank you, Terry. It was an amazing talk. So my question, I've realized recently that I also binge on my thoughts, and I have obsessive thoughts, and I'm having a hard time, you know, managing these thoughts. How do you deal with this situation? What is, you know, the steps you take when you feel like you've done a 10th step, you've done outreach, you know, prayed about it, and these obsessive thoughts just come in? And as an addict, I understand why I have them. But just to get some light over that. Thank you.
Sure. You know what, Aaliyah, when you asked that question, thank you so much, because, you know, isn't it funny how we come in here with obsessive thoughts about food, and then we get to see that we just have obsessive thinking? And I remember someone sharing that an obsessive thought crushes all other thoughts. And I've experienced that. I know exactly what you're talking about. We can think of nothing else. And the thing that comes to my mind is the passage I think it's in the sex conduct inventory, it might be in the ninth step. I don't remember, but it says, you know, when everything else fails and we can't get these thoughts off our mind, we need to get out of ourselves, because of myself, I'm just going to be nothing and keep up with the obsessive thought, which just keeps giving me nothing. I have to be of some use to someone else. And that doesn't necessarily mean I have to make it, you know, I have to make an outreach call. Maybe that's what it means. But maybe it means I need to be thinking about the person that I could be helpful to in this moment, as opposed to whatever the obsessive thought is. And usually it has nothing to do with whatever the obsessive thought is. Because if I'm obsessing about my children and I think helping my children is going to be how I get out of it, it's never going to work. It's like, you know, maybe what I need to do is go next door to the woman who just lost her husband and see how she's doing today. You know, maybe it's that. Maybe it's making a call to my shut-in mother-in-law and seeing how she's doing today. But it's like getting out of myself or doing something else that's useful. You know, I don't know. But that's the thing that comes to me. You know, the direction that came to me when you asked that was that. But I'm sure there's other direction from God if you ask for it. Hope that helps.
Thank you, Aaliyah A., for your question. All right, plenty of time. Who else has a question for Terry this morning? So I want to unmute.
Ian F.
Penny C.
Nancy Ian F. Penny C. Nancy L.
Natalie F.
Natalie.
Shayna R.
Okay, we have Ian F., Penny C., Nancy L., Natalie S., and Shayna R. Thank you. Beginning with Ian F., your question, please, Ian.
Hi, Ian F., compulsive overeater. Thank you, Terry. That was incredible. You said something that was and stuck with me, which was, when did I begin to believe that I was the only authentic person on the face of the earth and everyone else was insincere? And I've run into a trouble several times in my recovery where I'm really concerned about being like an OA Wonder Boy. Like I want to do this program really well, and I want to guard against any character defect. And I become so wrapped up in, am I doing the right thing? Am I free of defects, that I become obsessive about that. I become obsessive about never having any defects, and I get really self-righteous. And I just want to know, like, how do you balance keeping an eye on your defects, but also not falling into that obsessive behavior without falling into that obsessive thinking? I hope that's a coherent question.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Thanks, Ian. You know, something came to me when you were talking about, you know, the pride, the spiritual pride we can get in being in the rooms, right, of, you know, being a recovered person or whatever. You know, I have to bring it down. This was my prayer before I got on the meeting today. Help me stay in the sunlight and forget about the spotlight. Like that's just been really helpful to me, because I'm not good at distinguishing the two sometimes. So I'll say that about some of the thoughts that you mentioned. But for your question about, you know, balancing the person I want to be and sometimes how I show up, I'm going to word it that way. I think that's how I think I understood the question clearly, but we could talk offline if I don't answer the question correctly. I'm not good at evaluating myself, because I will say, gee, this looked like a good day. Look at everything I did. That looks pretty good. I'm not good at evaluating myself. I'm like, you know, I should never, ever be the person who evaluates my spiritual life. And I think that's what the 10th step and the 11th step tell me. I'm not a good judge. I need to go to God. Everything about inventory is a prayer. Everything about inventory is prayer. I have to ask God for help. I have to ask God to see whatever it is I need to see. And God will let me know, because, you know, when I was kind of being unkind to my husband 2 weeks ago, and I knew it had nothing to do about my husband, that living on a spiritual basis was eluding me and I couldn't figure out why. And I'm like, well, I started with him and you heard my story. It had nothing to do with him. In the end, it had a lot to do with the role I assigned myself with my mom. So all I can say is I'm not a good judge of my behavior. And it doesn't say watch and judge. It says watch and turn. So I just keep turning. I just keep turning with the faith and the belief that I will get direction, you know, right now. You know, bring me an addict to work with. I'm not the judge. I'm not a good judge. Like, oh yeah, okay, I'm going to work with this person. Oh, you know, show me who it is. Show me who it is. So I hope that's helpful, and be glad to talk offline if we need to discuss more.
Thank you, ENF. Penny C, your turn.
Thank you, Leia, and thank you, Terry. You mentioned, Terry, about the frailties that your mom is experiencing because of this disease. And I'm actually a year older than your mom. And what it made me think of and be grateful for is the avoidance of those frailties, the benefits I have as a recovered person. So what do you see as the benefits physically and maybe psychologically of living as a recovered person and avoiding the frailties of the disease as we get older?
Well, if I don't want to get clinical, but if I understand your question correctly, Penny, you know, my mom has immobility today. She does not get around well. And it's not because you know, it's neuropathy, it's diabetes, it's a lot of things. You know, we never see this disease on a death certificate, but we know it should be there. Like, I know it should be there. It wasn't on my dad's, but it should have been there. And today, like, I certainly don't claim physical perfection by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just grateful when I go in a doctor's office and I sit down and the typical question is, okay, tell me all your medications. And I say, none. And I have a doctor who tells me when I had an ailment recently that you must be really in touch with your body because you're pretty clear about something that a lot of people would have ignored or never known about. You know, today I honor my body. I'm not, you know, tomorrow I could succumb and cease to desist from a heart attack or a stroke or any of those things. I don't know. I don't know what kind of shape my body's in. At 33, when I walked in here, it was creaking. It was, you know, my organs were probably damaged somewhat. My skeletal system was strained. I don't know what kind of, you know, health longevity I have. But I know today, I can be active today. I can, you know, walk and exercise and do all kinds of things. Oh, by the way, one of the lines I learned in recovery is, I'm not an exerciser, but I love jumping to conclusions. And I just thought that for a little side note, because I'm not an exerciser, but I can be mobile today. My mom's immobile. I can be mobile today. I don't know how long I'm going to be around, but I know I'm going to keep asking God for help to keep doing this so that I might be, you know, might continue to live this life that I have. So hope that's helpful.
Yeah, if I could add one more thing. I know when I was over 200 pounds some 37 years ago, I avoided doctors. And today I take care of myself, and it's only because I practice these 12 steps and I do what God wants me to do, and that's to take care of this beautiful body that he gave me. So thank you again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Penny C. Nancy L.
Thank you, Leah. Mm-hmm. And thank you very much, Terry. Good morning. Nancy L., recovered in Arizona. My question is, Terry, if you have one of those days, you know, where things are just not going smoothly, let's put it that way, and then you come home, you sit down for dinner, you finish your dinner, my question is, do you ever get a thought like, I think a little bit more would help, I think I need a little bit more of my dinner, I think I need to go, let's say, get second servings? Just wondering if you're ever tempted with those thoughts. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nancy. I guess I'm not going to say no. I'm just going to say hasn't happened recently. But the answer to the question is yes. My tendency is not to go into the thinking about the food or see it when it's happening. My tendency is to eat my meals fast. If I'm eating super fast, you know, it's like, that's not recovery for me. That's not my abstinence. Like, and I can do it. Like, that's the behavior for me. Not so much the thought of the extra food. The extra food could be a thought, but I've eaten my meal so fast usually. Yeah, maybe that's it. Yeah, maybe I'm thinking, yeah, maybe to answer your question, yeah. Because, like, I'm like, oh, it's over with. It's gone. Oh, that's it. And when I'm disappointed about that, I look back, I've usually eaten too fast, and it's usually because I'm not in the moment. I'm somewhere else, and I'm being driven by fear. To me, fear is, you know, it's the evil and corroding thread. It's always the evil and corroding thread. If fear is driving me, God can't be driving me. Fear is driving me. And it shows in the food. It shows in my thoughts about food. So the answer is yes, I guess, and then to your point, maybe not exact, but yes. And it boils down to fear. Like, fear is at the root of all of it. So hope that's helpful.
Thank you, Nancy L. Natalie S., your turn.
Thank you. Hi, this is Natalie S. in Arizona. And my question, Terry, is as you release these roles that you played, and I really love the analogy that you shared, I'm one of those tweeners. I have older parents and children who were in their 20s, five of them. And as I learned to let them live their lives and play their roles and step in and step out and use the program to step out of their role, I find that I get these feelings. Sorry about that. That was a car on the road. And some of them are really deep feelings. Like I know when my dad died, the feeling of mourning, or when my daughter's going through a hard time. I just feel, and I understand that this is a thinking disease, and I totally know that for myself, but I'm just wondering if you could speak a little bit to what you do, how you manage those feelings in those situations. That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Natalie. Thank you, because, you know, there's something also poignant that I've learned for me. And this episode with my mom really helped me see it. And you're talking about feelings. Today, with the grace of God, I don't always see it, but eventually he shows me that I'm in pain. Like, I'm not suffering, but I'm in pain. And my pain with my mom was about sadness. And I, you know, sadness is something God will help me with. Sadness is something God's right there about, all about. Like, when I identify that's what's going on with me, and that's a legitimate feeling, I have to first acknowledge it, right? Nothing can be changed until it's acknowledged. And the fact that I'm human, and we, you know, humanity, the whole idea and premise of humanity is love for one another, that sadness will occur when another one of us is limited, hurt, interfered with, whatever the case may be. So, you know, God will help us with the feelings when that's what we know is going on. And I don't know, maybe that can be where you end up. The other one, you know, the suffering is without him. The suffering is without him. But that is pain for me. And it comes up. I'm very sad about my mom. But it's since I've acknowledged it and sat still with it and brought it to God, it's definitely lessened. And I can have that sadness about my children. You know, I had that on Mother's Day. I had a beautiful Mother's Day, and I came home and sobbed. I came home and sobbed. And the reason I sobbed was the realization that I'm letting them live their lives. They're living their lives. They're good people. And there's things that happen to them that I can't change that, you know, that are sad. They're just sad. So I hope that helps, but I really relate to what you're saying. You know, it's wonderful to be enlightened and see, you know, hold things up to the light and see intellectually what's going on. It's another thing to face the truth about it and know that it can hurt. It hurts. So I hope, yeah. Thanks for the question.
Thank you, Natalie S. Shayna R. Star one to unmute, Shayna R.
Hi, this is Shayna R. in Maryland. Thank you so much, Terry, for wonderful talk. Most Sundays I have a very hard time coming up with a question, but this Sunday I did not. I have been residing in a senior building for 10 years, and this one that I'm in, I hope your mother's is different, has been very dangerous and crime-ridden and very poorly managed. So my dilemma all along has been whether to try to change it or to leave. Leaving, though, has been very difficult. So I've had a hard time coming up with what my higher power wants me to do. Leaving feels like running away from a problem. Staying is, I think, takes and trying to change The things around here has been seems to demand more courage on my part. So I was wondering if you could give any suggestions as to what the best thing in my situation would be to do. That's my question. Thanks so much.
Sheena, I find that for any real life problem or dilemma, kind of going back to that skill set becomes important. And
Terry, press star one.
Okay, there we go. Thank you for whoever said that. I didn't realize I got unmuted. So, Shayna, I think that I have to go back to the skill set when I have a decision to make or a dilemma, or I think that perhaps God is urging me to make a change. And I have to look at the facts. I have to look at the facts and I have to hold it up to the light because, you know, much like we were just talking about with Natalie, I can't go with my feelings. I can't go with my feelings. I have to sometimes get them out of the way and look at the truth. And for sometimes that's hard for me to do. So starting with the facts, you know, facing the facts, see what the facts are. I don't even want to start to give an example of what that might be for you. But praying sincerely for your ideas to be set aside so that you can be a clear channel for what God might want for you. It, like I say, the answer doesn't always come on my terms, on my timeline, in the fashion that I would like it. But it'll come. It will come. So I hope that's helpful.
Thank you, Shayna R., for your question. We have time for probably one more question if someone would like the opportunity. Star one to unmute.
Patrick. Oh.
Patrick, you're the lucky one. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hello, I'm Patrick, and I'm dealing with the exact same thing with my mother. I took a leave of absence here in New Jersey. Can you just repeat about, like, I want to walk in right now and let her listen to this tape I just listened to. It's wonderful. My mother and my sister are both struggling with this disease in different ways. Could you just kind of talk about how I can't remember what it came from, the vision for you, and how your mother has the grace of God in her life, and just to kind of surrender to that position in my life, in my situation? Thank you so much.
Am I unmuted? I didn't unmute
yes.
myself. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay. Patrick, I you went in and out a little bit. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to respond and hopefully answer the question. I'm not sure if my mom has peace in her life today. I think what I said, and maybe this is what you were asking me to repeat, is God has brought me to an ideal, right? An ideal, something that he would like me to live up to that honors her dignity. And that ideal is that, you know, that he will bless her and he will keep her, and that I need to honor that relationship between her and her God. That gives me peace, actually, that ideal, when I practice it and when I live up to it. And I need God's help to do it. That's basically, you know, I think what you were talking about. I have peace when that ideal becomes the truth and real for me. I have peace when that ideal is something that I try to practice, or something that comes, you know, naturally, when I, rather than my tendency to correct, protect, you know, guard, that sort of thing. So I hope that's helpful, and I'll be giving my phone number if you want to talk further.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you to all who posed questions this morning. And, of course, thank you so much, Terry. Another deep, rich, and profound presentation from your experience trudging this road of happy destiny. So thank you so much for that. A gem for the archives, indeed it is.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Sure. Share ID for today, 21,472. That's 21472. And we're going to close now from page 164. It happens to be in a chapter entitled A Vision for You. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.